When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
Tonight on The Readout.
And I gotta say, Chris, now I'm looking at... There is a man on fire, Chris, in the middle of a square in front of me where protesters were standing. An individual has now set himself on fire.
NBC News correspondent Yasmin Vesuvian today reporting on the shocking self-immolation of a man outside of the Trump trial as it happened. This as the historic trial draws media attention from around the world. Also tonight, just a short time ago, Judge Marchand denied a last-minute appeal by Trump and declared to the former president and everyone else in court, we're going to have opening statements on Monday morning. This trial is starting. And we begin tonight with our new reality as a country and in the media as our first ever criminal trial of a former U.S. president is slated to get underway bright and early Monday morning in the state of New York versus Donald Trump. The jury of 12 plus six alternates was sworn in this afternoon, much more quickly than almost anyone expected. But the reality that we're now faced with is that my industry, the media, which has struggled with how to cover a former president who fomented an actual insurrection and is running for president again, now has to figure out how to cover the absolute spectacle of him being on trial. The historic undertaking is understandably attracting a global media presence, which, of course, is what Trump wants and thrives on. Expect him to use the media packed outside the courtroom to do his Trump show every day of the trial. But the crush of media gathered in Manhattan is far outpacing the population of what Donald Trump also wanted to see. He had called for a massive outpouring of his supporters to rise up while he's stuck in the courtroom. But the designated protest area across the street that he wanted to be filled with his fans has been anything but. Only a few dozen people showed up earlier in the week, vastly outnumbered by the crush of reporters. But the designated protest area is a space for anyone who wants to make a point, whatever that point may be. With a massive throng of cameras and reporters from around the world just across the street. That is what happened today, minutes after the full jury was impaneled inside the courthouse. Now, I should warn you, the following image is graphic. It shows a man who set himself on fire in that designated protest area. The man was taken to a hospital. He is alive and in critical condition. Police have identified him as Maxwell Azzarello of St. Augustine, Florida. He had arrived in New York sometime earlier in the week. Three law enforcement officers told NBC News that he may have posted his intention to set himself on fire in advance on his Substack. And while the investigation is ongoing, it definitely raises concerns, not just about the security and safety of those involved with the trial itself. It raises that other point that I mentioned about what the spectacle of the Trump trial of the 21st century might attract over the next several weeks, and the question of why a young man would self-immolate in the park.
We do not believe he is, this was targeting any particular person or any particular group. We just, right now, label it as a sort of a conspiracy theorist.
Joining me now is NBC News correspondent Yasmin Vesuvian, who witnessed the self-immolation in the park in front of that courtroom, in front of that courthouse. Jim Cavanaugh, retired ATF special agent in charge and MSNBC contributor. And Michael Beschloss, NBC News presidential historian and friend of the show. Yasmin Vesuvian, I do want to start with you. Tell us about that moment you were there and witnessed it live.
It was an unbelievable joy moment to see, I gotta say. I was on the air live with Chris Jensen earlier on in the day. There was history in the making, right? This was the first jury ever seated for this historic trial in which we will all be watching very closely over the next 6 weeks. And then I heard a scream out of my right ear in which someone said he is setting himself on fire. And I turned to my right just off camera, and about 50 feet in front of me, Joy, really half a block, half a New York City block, I see a large plume of fire. about 20 to 25 feet high. And I got to say, in my head, I thought for a moment, okay, that is an area that is cordoned off for protesters. I've seen protesters there back in April when the former president was first arraigned. There were protesters there on Monday as well. That number has gone down every single day since then. And so I thought someone set off a fire. And then I looked more closely as I was speaking live with Chris, and I saw the outline of an individual's body. And I thought to myself, that is a human being. They have set themselves on fire, Joy. And his hands were raised in the air as he was standing there, arms wide open. And he burned for 2 minutes. It seemed like a lifetime, but it was 2 to 3 minutes. And then collapsing to the ground as security personnel, members of the FDNY, members of NYPD showed up and were able to put out that fire. And I got to say, Joy, what I saw with my own eyes and what his body had gone through at that moment is unexplainable. And his body then shook and EMT showed up. They put him on a stretcher and they carried him out. When he lit himself on fire, Joy, I was told by another person, another witness that saw this all go down, that he initially had knelt down, and we learned this from officers as well during the press conference. He had reached into his backpack and he had thrown up into the air a ton of papers. Then he had doused himself in fluid, in lighter fluid of some sort. He had used a lighter then to light himself on fire. On those papers were wide-ranging conspiracy theories. Honestly, none of it made sense. It was all nonsensical. It was political. Some of it was about the mob. Some of it was about various universities here in New York, as well as throughout the country. They were wide-ranging conspiracy theories. Whether or not that is what motivated this individual to do that, we don't know. But it was a shocking moment, juxtaposing that to what we were also reporting on at that very moment, which was impaneling a jury to sit and decide the fate of the ex-president of the United States. It was an incredible moment to see as a journalist and as a citizen here in New York. It's something that you imagine seeing in a war zone. Mm-hmm. I've reported in war zones before, but you would never imagine seeing in downtown Manhattan, in my hometown, when they're to report on the former president of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, and Jim Kavanaugh, I mean, just to listen to Yasmin explain that, it's harrowing because even that type of protest is not a protest that is typical in the United States. I mean, we did see it with the young man who protested. There was a Free Palestine protester. He was a military veteran, lit himself on fire. That was a rare kind of Western version of this. These are protests that, you know, during the Vietnam War, we would see Tibetan monks do. You know, this was that kind of a protest. So it's very unusual in Western society for someone to do that. And it also doesn't appear to be related to this trial. But this trial is going to attract just intense media attention. It's going to attract media, which means it's going to attract whoever wants to use that media for whatever purposes they have, including tragic.
Well, exactly. Exactly, Joy. Well, first, let me say, you know, what great reporting here. I mean, you're at the spot of a big event, a trial of a former president, and you witness a horrible suicide, a violent death. That's what this is. That's what Yasmin witnessed and described for us. And this is why we have a free press. And I think Michael can elaborate on that for us deeply. But this is why we have a free society, because we can have correspondents that can report actually what is actually going on, because we can't all be there. But look, this person traveled from Florida. And I've worked these cases where people strap bombs on themselves, they blow themselves up, they kill themselves, fire, explosives, you know, firearms. We were always involved in that with ATF, and I think you saw ATF agents on the scene there because they're the government's bomb and arson experts. So, yes, people do this to themselves. But the point here is the person traveled from Florida, Joy, all the way to the Trump trial. This is not connected to Trump. It has really nothing to do with him. I read all his writings that he posted. It's nonsensical, as Yasmin clearly reported. It doesn't make any sense. He names everybody, every politician, every Hollywood person, every billionaire, every person on the news, every little name he can think of. He ties them all together in some crackpot conspiracy theory. He's a disturbed person. It doesn't make any sense. I think the good part of that, though, is, you know, hopefully the judge will take a look at that and to reassure his jurors that this was not directed at the trial, at Mr. Trump, at them, at the court family. I mean, I hope he takes the time to do that. I would even say, you know, to the judges, you know, consider letting the jurors read his rantings, which are only just a couple of pages. But I think once you read it, you will be more relaxed that this was not anything directed at you.
Yeah.
And just to close, the Secret Service protection of Mr. Trump, I've been on many of these details. Let me tell you, they were not at all worried about his security. He's in that large courthouse building. This is outside in a fenced-in area with lots of NYPD and New York County courts police. They're not worried about that. They would have had protective intelligence special agents outside. They would witness that. They were getting it on their earplugs right away. They know exactly what's going on. They know exactly the danger. The danger here is not to Mr. Trump. The danger here is to the court family, the jurors, for other mentally disturbed individuals, emotional people that can come to this location, which is the center now. It kind of becomes a place like the White House or the Capitol. You know, where emotionally disturbed people are drawn to it like a magnet.
Yeah.
And so that's the danger going forward.
Indeed. And, you know, Michael, because, and so this is, it is an, this is a never before occurring, never before occurrence in the United States, a former president of the United States on trial, in a criminal trial, thankfully. But it is a spectacle that is unique. Give us a little bit of context for it, because it can attract anything. It can be a carnival. Donald Trump wanted it to be a protest. It's not. It's not attracting supporters of his, but it is attracting cameras. And that it's just different. It's not, it's the trial of the century without cameras inside the courtroom. They're outside.
It is. And as we say all the time, you and all four of us, you know, he's not guilty until proven guilty, if he ever is. But the people who founded this country were not exactly anticipating that someone who was a president of the United States, and even more, who's seeking the people's affirmative vote to become president again, would be on criminal trial. What? We're 6 months before the election, 7 months before the election. It just boggles the mind. But you know what I would love to do? I know the readout has no investigative unit, but I wish you did, because I'd love to know who was the brilliant genius on the Trump campaign staff who said he can campaign from the courtroom. Well, what we heard about today and saw in those drawings, and we'll get a lot more detail, is someone, this is the opposite of campaigning to get votes. He's losing votes. He shows no strength. There's about no place in the world where you're showing that you're less in control when you're sitting in a courtroom with a jury and a judge. This is someone who is on display for 8 hours a day. I think it's probably fair to say charitably, this is not someone in the best mental or physical or emotional shape. That's going to be on display for hours. And my historical point, and I'll end with this, is when in modern times have we gotten to see a presidential nominee to be, as he shortly will be, on display for 8 hours? You know, usually we see them in campaign bites, you know, in very carefully scripted appearances. If he's trying to make the argument that he's at his peak and he's just as alert as possible and he's totally, you know, tanned, rested, and ready to become president of the United States, he's going to have to get through this for 8 hours a day for 6 weeks or more.
Indeed. Yeah, we saw Hillary Clinton sit for 11 hours of a deposition and she stayed awake the entire time. Donald Trump did not manage to keep his eyes open during his 8 hour day today or previously. Yasmin Vesuvian, excellent reporting. Great job out there. Thank you very much.
Indeed.
Jim Kavanaugh, Michael Beschloss, we thank all of you so much. And
thank
coming up. Thank you. With a full jury now seated in Donald Trump's first criminal trial, with opening statements set for Monday morning, we've got more of the latest from the dramatic day in that New York courtroom today.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood which means affordable, high-quality, basic healthcare for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the healthcare we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves healthcare. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
President Trump, are you going to testify?
Yes.
Leaving the courtroom today, Donald Trump says he will testify in his first criminal trial, which appears to be moving full steam ahead. 12 jurors and 6 alternates have officially been selected and sworn in. And opening statements are set to begin Monday morning. But we did not get here without some intense and at times emotional moments inside the courtroom. To quote my colleague, the great Lisa Rubin, if today's jury selection had a theme song, it would be Under Pressure. This morning, 3 prospective jurors, all of whom are women, expressed concerns about their inability to serve due to their fears surrounding the case. The first juror was dismissed after saying she has really bad anxiety and wouldn't be able to be completely here and fair, adding, "People have found out where I am." Another broke down crying while she was being questioned, saying, "I have to be honest. I feel so nervous and anxious right now." A third juror was excused after saying she felt anxiety and self-doubt, her voice audibly cracking while answering questions. All of this underscores the unique challenge the jurors in this trial face, a trial that at times has felt more like that of a mob boss than that of a former president. Today, for example, Trump's attorneys once again asked for the name of the first witness, which the DA's office has refused to share with the defense due to the fact that Trump has been posting about everyone and anyone involved in the case on social media, including the judge and his family. The DA's office responded that they will give the name on Sunday and, quote, "If that should be tweeted, that'll be the last time we provide that courtesy." And who could blame them? I mean, we are talking about someone who has multiple times compared himself favorably to America's most infamous mobster, Al Capone.
"I've been indicted more than Alphonse Capone, Mr. President. Do you know who that is? Even the president just said, I do. Scarface, Al Capone. If he had dinner with you and he didn't like the smile in your face, he thought you were mocking him by smiling, you would be dead before you got home and said hello to your wife."
Joining me now is Lisa Rubin, MSNBC legal correspondent, and Harry Littman, former U.S. attorney. Lisa, I mean, Donald Trump saying if Al Capone didn't like you, you'd be dead before you made it home. That's how he talks. Talk about the spectacle of potential jurors, including women who are nervous and know that their names could get out, having to sit before him today and potentially be on this jury.
Joy, I was most struck by the second of the 3 jurors that you were talking about, because that prospective juror, during answering the jury questionnaire, revealed that she had 2 relationships that might be potentially of interest to the former president. First, her father is lifelong friends with another American politician who is infamously a nemesis of the former president. And she also added that she works at a company at which a famous witness who was also engaged in a grudge match with former President Trump, he has a son who works there too. And although she didn't know him, she said it was possible that she could encounter him in the future. And then when Susan Nicholas, who's one of former President Trump's lawyers, got up to question the jurors about whether they could be fair, whether they would accept principles like the fact that somebody changes their story multiple times might be evocative of the fact that they're not telling the truth. During some of that questioning, that's when the juror cracked. Not before, not with anything else going on, she literally burst into tears and said, "I feel so nervous and anxious right now. I don't know that I can do this." And you could feel the empathy of all of the people in the overflow room where I was sitting with about 100 journalists, just everyone really feeling for this woman, because we understand that this isn't a person who just talks like Al Capone and compares himself favorably to Al Capone, but is facing a contempt hearing on Tuesday for what? For 10 public statements, most of them social media posts, where he has talked about witnesses in the case and at one point quoted a Fox News host who was talking about liberal activists trying to insert themselves secretly onto this jury. That's enough to make anybody nervous.
And there's also the issue of sexual assault, which came up in the case. Talk a little bit about that, because this involves what Stormy Daniels will ultimately testify to and whether jurors had essentially would not be able to be objective based on that issue.
There is a prospective juror who talked about having been a victim of sexual assault not once, but twice. And she was asked again by Susan Nicholas, one of Trump's lawyers, whether that would be a problem for her, given some of the accusations against former President Trump. At that point, she said, these are accusations that are entirely outside the case. And you could hear some of the journalists in the room gasp because, as you just noted, Stormy Daniels has recently characterized the relationship that she had with former President Trump as something other than perfectly consensual. And so you can tell now that that's going to be a disputed issue in the case. Whether or not they had a relationship is one contested fact, right? Because President Trump is going to maintain he never was engaged in any sexual affairs of any kind with Stormy Daniels or Karen McDougal, the Playboy model, who received a settlement from the National Enquirer on his behalf. But more than that, Even if the jurors are inclined to believe there was something going on, Stormy Daniels has indicated that she intends to tell her truth, which is that that relationship between them wasn't one she entered willingly. And I have the feeling that that is going to be a big theme here, as it has been in the E. Jean Carroll case. And the district attorney announced today that if they get to cross-examine former President Trump, they believe the verdicts in both of the E. Jean Carroll cases are fair game, including the finding that Trump sexually assaulted E. Jean Carroll.
And Harry, let's get in on what the prosecutors are thinking now. They're going to have to give the name of whoever that person is. And this is what Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who specializes in autocracy, she said, as a scholar of strongmen, I agree with Mary Trump, that's Trump's niece's assessment of the psychological cost of the trial for Trump. Some individuals cannot bear the feeling of being constrained by others. The usual forms of asserting dominance are not available to him in the courtroom, but they are available outside the courtroom. As soon as that name is released, we know what he's going to do.
So a few things. First, their non-release of it, Joy, it's not a small point. You can guarantee that the two Trump lawyers are going to have a hellish weekend. It's one thing to prepare solidly to cross-examine someone you know who it will be, that it could be anyone at all. That's a serious sort of sanction for his misbehavior. But second, yes, it is exactly as you say. There's been, on the one hand, Judge Merchan made quick work of things, Justice Merchan, but yet there are these eruptions of kind of chaos and stress, and we have almost a tale of two trials. And as it goes forward, those will be the sort of high points that people remember. And this trial could be really freighted going forward, or it could stay smooth. It's been two different kinds of weeks, it seems to me.
And if you were prosecuting this case, who would you call first? Because there are different ways to do it. I mean, Michael Cohen was at the start of the catch and kill trial, as was David Pecker from the National Enquirer. Or they could go back and start with Stormy Daniels. What would you anticipate being that first witness?
Yeah, it's a great and big question. Cohen, they've said, is going to be the sort of tour guide, but I think it'd be a mistake and they won't start with him. My best guess is Pecker. They will first start the story, the whole kind of catch and kill through McDougal, and then set things up for either that or a very sort of banal witness that just goes through paperwork. But I think they'll start with low emotional intensity, but then try to frame the story and have Cohen somewhere in the middle. You don't want him as the last. You don't want him as the first.
And give us a sense of what we should expect to see, Lisa, on Monday morning at 9:30 sharp a.m.
Well, at 9:30 sharp, Joy, we're going to have a little bit of judicial housekeeping. Just Mershon is going to tell us what the permissible scope is going to be of that cross-examination about Trump's prior misconduct and unlawful acts. But after that, we're going to get straight to opening statements from the DA's office and then in turn from Trump's lawyers. And I don't expect that that will take more than an hour and change on either side. And then, as Harry said and previewed, we'll get to the first witness. And my prediction is that first witness is going to be David Pecker. And that's because the very first event in this indictment, if you're going chronologically, is a 2015 meeting at Trump Tower between Cohen, Pecker, and a person that our own Tom Winter reported in 2018 was none other than Donald Trump. Putting Trump in the room at the beginning of the scheme is critical, and not having Michael Cohen do it is even more critical.
Lisa Rubin, Harry Littman, thank you. And I expect to see you don't make a lot of plans for the next 6 weeks. Thank you both very much. Coming up next, Israel launches missile strikes into Iran as fears grow of a widening conflict in the Middle East. The readout continues after this.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
No Israeli leader has been fixated on Iran as long or as consistently as Benjamin Netanyahu. Since his first year in office in 1996, Netanyahu has been sounding the alarm about Iran's nuclear ambitions, saying a nuclear Iran would be catastrophic. In his first speech to a joint session of Congress in Washington, D.C., he said time was running out. In the years since, he has threatened to attack Iran if it were to develop nuclear weapons. A threat that is backed by the fact that Israel has nuclear weapons, though they rarely acknowledge that publicly. Netanyahu's obsession with Iran, an obsession that I should note is mutual, takes on fresh resonance during an unprecedented week of direct attacks between the two countries, which have long been engaged in a proxy war. Overnight, Israel carried out a limited strike, firing three air-launched ballistic missiles into Iran, targeting an airbase. Israel had vowed it would respond to Iran's retaliatory strike on Saturday when Iran fired more than 300 drones and missiles at Israel in its first direct military assault on the country. The Iranian strikes were in retaliation for an Israeli strike April 1st on an Iranian consular building in Syria, which killed two of Iran's top generals. But there is another key reason for Netanyahu's singular focus on Iran. It happens to take the attention and the heat off of Gaza. Joining me now is Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute. The attack, Trita, felt a little wag the dog-ish to me. These attacks don't seem designed to maybe spark a World War III, but it definitely took attention away from Gaza. What do you make of what Israel is doing at the moment?
Well, certainly this exchange between Iran and Israel since the Israeli attack on the Iranian consulate on April 1st has taken a tremendous amount of attention away from Gaza. And that definitely is a problem. I think, however, the scale of the attack against Iran last night was much less than what the Israelis themselves wanted to. They had been clearly warned by the Biden administration not to escalate this further. And even though they didn't abide by what Biden had demanded, which was no attack at all, they nevertheless did something that was of such a low scale that it made it possible for the Iranians to pretend as if they had not been attacked at all. And as a way, as a result, escape this escalation ladder that both sides were on. And as a result, the entire region is drawing a sigh of relief because, at least for now, in the immediate term, the risk of a regional war has gone down somewhat.
You know, I am old enough to remember Bibi Netanyahu really pushing the U.S. to invade Iraq and also really goading the U.S. to maybe follow that by invading Iran, and which would have been absolutely disastrous. Even the Cato Institute, the conservative Cato Institute, said absolutely horrible idea. What is his goal here? Because if he's not trying to make a wider war in the Mideast, then what is he doing?
He is trying to survive politically. And there were cabinet ministers in his cabinet that thought that this attack was far too small. They even tweeted that it was lame, which showed that there's a lot of divisions within the cabinet on how to respond to this. But what Netanyahu is doing more than anything else right now is to survive politically. That, unfortunately, means prolonging the war in Gaza and potentially enlarging the war onto the rest of the Middle East. This is part of the reason why I think it's very crucial for the United States to make sure that its policy here is not wedded to Netanyahu. It doesn't follow Netanyahu, because Netanyahu's objective is not to end the war in Gaza. It is not to avoid a regional war. It's the opposite.
And yet, Trita, what we've seen the United States do is once again veto most of our allies' agreement that Palestine should be admitted as a full member of the United Nations, which caused, of course, consternation by the Palestinian minister to the UN, who seemed utterly distraught. But also now we're at odds with our European allies and some allies in Asia who were for it. I don't really think I understand even the U.S. positioning here.
I think you're one of many who are scratching their heads and trying to figure out. We've said for so long that we're in favor of a two-state solution. And when we have the opportunity to allow the Palestinian state, not necessarily its borders, but nevertheless, the state be admitted into the UN as a full member, we are alone in vetoing it against close allies, Japan, South Korea, other states who all voted in favor, France. This is really, really shameful, but I fear that it reveals that from the very outset, or at least for the last two decades, we have not been entirely honest in trying to bring about a Palestinian state. And part of the reason why we have so much violence now is precisely because the diplomatic path to a Palestinian state, to a two-state solution, has essentially been closed off. And everyone knew that if we close it off, if we're not serious about it, there will be a return to violence. And that's what happened on October 7th. If we don't shift now, I fear that we will see even more violence down the road.
And I mean, Ehud Olmert, the former prime minister of Israel, said to me directly on the show that he believes a clear break with Netanyahu would be in the interest of both Israel and the United States and of President Biden politically. He didn't seem to understand why Biden won't do it. Do you?
No, I think what Biden is trying to do right now, frankly, is that he wants to get a deal between Israel and Saudi Arabia that he will then present as some sort of a peace deal. But it is nothing but a continuation of what Trump started with the Abraham Accords, which was explicitly throwing the Palestinians under the bus, that it was explicitly ignoring the Palestinian issue and essentially saying, all we need to do is to have direct flights between Dubai and Israel and Ben-Gurion Airport, and that amounts to peace in the region. If he chooses to go down this path, which I fear is what they're trying to do right now, which is part of the reason why he vetoed the statehood resolution, he wants it to come through that deal. Part of the reason why they've not been serious about a ceasefire, they wanted to come through the deal with Saudi Arabia and Israel, is precisely that belief. But it is not going to lead to peace. It's going to sow the seeds for the next conflict next year.
And there stands Iran, where we did have a deal during the Obama administration to at least bring them into the world of nations and talk to them. And we threw that out the window during Donald Trump. What a world. Trita Parsi, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And coming up, Republicans continue their efforts to erode child labor laws. Oh, wow. Happy 21st century. The House tees up votes on Ukraine and Israel aid this weekend. Plus, the stark reality that women in post-Roe America are facing. Lots to get to. Stay with us.
We had a choice. Were we going to put people over politics? Because the political thing to do is always to let the extreme MAGA Republicans crash and burn because they have so many out of control members, they cannot govern on their own. And we could let them simply crash and burn. But when we say we're going to continue to put people over politics, we actually mean it.
Blocked for months by Republicans, it was Democrats who stepped in and got Congress functioning again, with the House finally adopting a rule Friday to take up a $95.3 billion aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan in a bipartisan show of support that likely paves the way for passage tomorrow. That bipartisanship seemed to trigger some of the MAGA members who were furious that an extremist border bill was not included. Now, mind you, they could have had a bipartisan border bill, too, but they chose to kill it at Donald Trump's request.
Johnson has become his reputation, his history, his legacy will be the speaker who got things done with Democrats. And unfortunately, that's a fact. I don't even recognize the person that I once called a friend.
That was not a joke. They really do think that bipartisanship is bad. They also think that helping Ukraine is so bad that three insurrectionist Republicans, Representatives Marjorie Taylor Greene, Thomas Massie, and Paul Gosar, decided to back a motion to kick fellow election denier Mike Johnson out of the speakership, just like they did to Kevin McCarthy. The latest hot MAGA mess left one of their Republican colleagues wondering who they're rooting for.
I guess their reasoning is they want Russia to win so badly that they want to oust the speaker over it. I mean, it's a strange position to take. I think they want to be in the minority, too. I think that's an obvious reality.
Joining me now is Charles Blow, columnist for The New York Times and MSNBC political analyst, and Liz Winstead, founder and chief creative officer at the Abortion Access Front. Thank you both for being here. Charles, he said it best, right? The MAGA Republicans want Russia to win and they want to be in the minority. What do you think?
Yeah, they don't care if Russia wins is probably the best formulation of that. I don't think that they care much about foreign policy. I think that they care about creating chaos. I think they care about toeing the line for Donald Trump and making him look good. And all of them want to do, this game where they just say, if I close my eyes and just don't pay attention to it, it'll go away. I wish it would go away, too. But I understand foreign policy, and it's not going to go away. Russia is knocking on the door of Ukraine, knocking down the door of Ukraine. That doesn't stay put. If Russia keeps marching forward, attacks a NATO country, now we're drawn in because we are, we're part of NATO. It doesn't just stay there. And I think that they don't care about that. And Donald Trump doesn't care about that. He keeps saying, well, it would just go away if I was the president, or it never would have happened if I was the president. Actually, it has nothing to do with whether or not you are in the hot seat. It has to do with Russia's motivations. It has to do with geopolitics writ large. And I think that what Hakeem Jeffries said there was really important. Somebody has to step to the front and say, this is not a small, dispute we're having on the playground. This is a big deal, and we have to deal with it as adults.
Well, adults are kind of hard to find nowadays in the House of Representatives. Liz Winstead, let me just tell you some of Marjorie Greene's 20 amendments to the Ukraine bill, and she had four on the Israel bill. One of them was to package funding for the development of a space laser. She wants a space laser on the southern border, a space laser that I guess she thinks is the Iron Dome, but she thinks there are space lasers. She wants to have she had an amendment that would require any member who voted in favor of the aid package to conscript in the Ukrainian military. The response from Representative Jared Moskowitz of Florida, he added his own amendment that would name Marjorie Taylor Greene as Vladimir Putin's special envoy to the United States Congress. And another would rename the Cannon Office the Neville Chamberlain Room. It's, what are we doing?
I mean, first of all, she's putting me out of business. It's like when you can't even make the jokes and somebody's just doing reality, that's really hard. But, the thing is, we all have base things we have to do at our jobs, right? Like very, very basic things. When the people of America and these MAGA Republicans who vote for these people are okay with them not even doing baseline funding. Like, that's okay. What is their purpose? Isn't that the question that we all should be asking at this point? Like, what is your purpose if you can't do the bare minimum?
Right. And if then why aren't their voters holding them accountable for it? Because apparently their voters don't want them to do anything. They just want this. And to stay with you just for a moment, one of the things they are doing at the state level and in the congressional level very aggressively is taking away women's rights. AP, the Associated Press, has all of these horror stories they've come out with about women who went to the emergency room and no one would treat them. One was left to miscarry in a lobby restroom. Another had to call 911 from a hospital bathroom so that someone would come and get her to treat her. This is insane, Liz. We're in a world now where women are literally threatened with dying in the waiting room, in the ER.
And being turned away because they literally are saying, we don't have anybody who can do any gynecological or obstetric care in this hospital. People, doctors are fleeing Idaho, Texas. Emergency rooms and OBGYNs are closing down any kind of obstetrics wings because of these abortion bans. And so when these, yet again, these gynoticians who keep writing these laws and creating these draconian bans never actually are required to look at the big picture of what it means. And now we're seeing what the big picture means. And the hatred of women has become, it's almost like you can't believe it, but we have to start connecting with it because it's just true.
Yeah, I mean, and it's obvious. And I'm sitting here in the great state of Georgia, Charles, a state that's got a 6-week abortion ban for which Brian Kemp was never punished. No Republicans have paid a price for doing to this state what they're now trying to do to states like Arizona, what they did in Iowa, what they're doing in Florida, where there might be political consequences. Why aren't there more political consequences for somebody like a Brian Kemp who did this to women here?
Because what Republicans are doing is playing the game of collateral damage. In their minds, many of them, not all, but many of them say, oh, that may be bad, but in my mind, that's collateral damage that I accept for saving babies. Right. And this is what I think America has not done is connect the dots across all the issues. All of these things are connected. The collateral damage game is the game they always play. It may be bad to separate people, the immigrants from their children, but that is the collateral damage we have to accept in order to secure the border. It may be bad that we have school shootings, but that's collateral damage that we have to accept to have our insane view of the Second Amendment. Police shootings of Black people may be bad, but it's something we have to accept to keep crime low. Until America start to connect all of this, and don't just fight when it's your issue, fight when anybody makes a collateral damage argument that some people are disposable because that is what we have to do to achieve our objective. Until we all start to fight on that front, on this issue, on every other one that they use that on, we will continue to lose this fight.
Amen.
Charles,
amen to that. Okay. Really quick, because I'm about to go to break. Real quick.
Oh, I was just going to say, it's so right, because what they keep doing is asking at what point our humanity can be turned over to the government.
Absolutely. Okay, well, we are not letting Charles and Liz go anywhere, because they're going to stick around to play Who Won the Week right after the break. Well, folks, we made it to the end of another week, which means it is time to play our favorite game. Ah, yes. Who won the week? Back with me, Charles Blow and Liz Winstead. Charles Blow, who won the week?
Stormy Daniels. I believe this is a woman who Trump mocked, denied that he'd ever done this. And, you know, and people have whatever they can say about her line of work. But she has a story, and that's her story. And now she gets her day in court.
She is fierce and fabulous. I can't wait to hear her testify. Liz Winstead, who do you believe won the week?
Well, in this reproductive hellscape where we're just dying to have any kind of expansion of access to reproductive care, the rats of New York City are getting a delicious contraceptive. We can't get any contraceptive, but the rats are getting a savory birth control. And I think if you talk to any woman and somebody said you can have poutine that is birth control, we would be very excited.
How do rats have more rights than women in America? What is the hellscape that we have entered? Okay. My Who Won the Week, I want to first acknowledge it is the 30th anniversary of one of the greatest rap albums in history, Nas's Illmatic. This is the 30th anniversary. I feel sufficiently old, but it was one of the greatest albums of all time. But my Who Won the Week is a young woman named Morgan Price, Fisk University gymnast who won the 2024 USA Gymnastics Women's Collegiate National Championships, all around first HBCU gymnast to win such a thing. You go, girl. Morgan Price won the week. Charles Blow, Liz Winstead, thank you very much. That is tonight's readout.
Today's news requires more facts, more context, and more analysis. The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try MSNBC. Understand more.